Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, welcome to Heritage Radio Network. We dig plants. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And today marks the end of our 2016 season. And we're ending with a whopper of a topic, the garden at the High Line. Now, this is like the creme de la creme project in New York City.
Yes.
This is the newest public park, and we have with us today our old friend John Gunderson, senior gardener, to discuss some of his favorite plants and the larger idea of transformation in the landscape, both designed and wild. So for our listeners that have not yet seen or have experience with the High Line, let's describe what this magnificent garden project is and give some New York history to illustrate its importance. The High Line is an elevated industrial railway that is now converted to a walking promenade. It was originally constructed in the 1930s to move freight in the industrial west side downtown and to eliminate railroad tracks on the streets, which were incredibly dangerous to New Yorkers. So the tracks were elevated some 30 feet off the ground from street level, and it was designed to travel through the industrial buildings and to offload wares and raw materials via two side-by-side locomotives. So this is a heavily trafficked rail line.
Originally.
It used to be at street level, pedestrian, so they elevated this train, and now there's this amazing park on it. Thank you for that sound effects. So the train stopped running in 1980, and basically the elevated sat dormant, and it was in litigation for many, many years as to what to do with this, which is a typical New York City story with regard to property. And so there's this crumbling infrastructure, right? So then 1993, in France, the Promenade Plantée was opened, and the idea of a public garden that floated above the city and offered peace and solitude was adopted here in New York City via Friends of the High Line advocacy group. Carmen, do you want to read what author Philip Lopate write?
Sure. The fact that this new amenity sprang from older industrial infrastructure says a lot about the current moment in New York's evolution. A city that had once pioneered so many technological and urban planning solutions, that had dazzled the world with its public works, its skyscrapers, bridges, subways, water delivery system, its Central Park, palatial train stations, libraries, and museums, appears unable to undertake any innovative construction on a grand scale and is now consigned to cannibalizing its past and retrofitting it to function as an image, a consumable spectacle. Productivity has given way to narcissism, or to put it more charitably, work has yielded to leisure.
So leisure in New York City, right?
Yeah.
It's no longer is Central Park enough, right?
No.
We have a huge population growth. And we're demanding more open space. So a transformation from work and industry to leisure.
And we don't have more space.
We don't.
We can't fill
we
in.
We are limited.
Correct. Yeah. We're an island. We're islands, you know, so.
Yeah, the East River and the Hudson.
Impinge upon.
Yeah. And what's interesting about New York is we never saw the waterway as a place of leisure. It was always industry. It was always warehouse. And
correct.
Freight.
We always turned our backs on the waterfront.
Exactly.
Recently, we're starting to actually look at that resource.
Exactly. So here's a transformation of crumbling infrastructure into new public pedestrian parkland. And what's super interesting is the flora and fauna that overtook these tracks in this dormant period was a veritable wildflower garden and a pseudo forest that existed on and among these tracks. So again, it's a transformation of nature from Henry Hudson's forests to industrial era coal-burning sweatshop livelihood, back to wild natives growing in these dormant tracks, and now this cultivated, very cultivated planting plan where prairie-style maintenance methods are celebrated, worshipped, and cultivated.
Yeah, and for those who don't know New York, it's in the Chelsea neighborhood.
Right.
Pretty much.
The park, the park runs from Ganzevoort at the where the Whitney Museum is now, all the way to 34th Street, and that's the only part of the abandoned rail line that was salvaged from demolition.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
and Chelsea was a rough neighborhood,
and the meatpacking district.
Yes. It was used to be filled with prostitutes, you know, just working people.
Yep.
There was no. It was not. And now, when you go. It's a completely different
place. Very different, and we've, I think, lost a lot of the history of that area in terms of the restaurants that were there. When I grew up, I used to live on 11th Street when I was in college.
Uh-huh.
So I knew the area, but we've lost a lot of the history, but there's a new history being done. So.
It is a new history, right. So what I also find really interesting about this is that New York City is home, right, to these large-scale projects, and we went back to our roots, so to speak, to our Dutch ancestry, and we hired Pete Odoff, the quintessential plantsman from the Netherlands.
And Dutchman, yeah.
Right. And the Dutch are always transforming our landscape, right? They have such profound impact on us.
And they also really understand how to work around water limitations. I mean, their entire country is basically built, is man-made.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's just basically, so they know how to make use of minimal resources in space.
Absolutely.
Which is great. You know?
So a few years back, Carmen and I had a garden shop in the neighborhood of Williamsburg, which, how many years ago was that? 2006 and 2007.
Yes.
Yeah, so 8 years ago.
The neighborhood had just been recently rezoned, right, from industrial commercial to high-end condo land, which is what it is now.
Yes.
Right. At the time, it was very similar to the meatpacking district.
Exactly.
In Chelsea. It was actually not the safest area. I was living out there since 80, actually, I think, 91.
Yeah, so John was living in Greenpoint, which is the neighborhood just to the north of Williamsburg.
Right.
Carmen and I thought, like, hey, garden center, like, there's going to be all these new condos. People need plants. Let's open a garden center.
Yeah.
So we opened the shop. And we met John because he was working in a design architecture firm above our shop. And John would spend a lot of time hanging out with us.
He would visit us like daily.
Like daily.
I was poking around.
Yeah.
Obviously. And thinking about something.
About something. Transformation, right?
Right.
So finally one day, he said to us while sitting around, I think we were having coffee, sitting on the lounge chairs in our garden shop. And he said, how do I become a gardener? And Carmen and I said, oh my God, he wants to become a gardener. So.
I had gardened most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was more about realizing that I was not following what I truly wanted to do. Because as a gardener, I pretty much was satisfied in many different ways. In ways that I wasn't satisfied as a designer. Although that was a satisfying career. So the question was, how do I actually make that step in the best way possible for it to actually work out for me? I was not that young. I'm not that young now.
Right.
So it was more about that. Talked to a few people, some landscape architects and stuff, in terms of how to actually formalize this.
Uh-huh.
And I did, after speaking to some good friends who convinced me to sort of take the leap, went to school at the New York Botanical Gardens School of Professional Horticulture. and sort of took it full on.
Uh-huh.
Even if it was just to prove that it was not the right decision, but it turned out to be the right decision.
Uh-huh.
And I was lucky enough to be hired at the High Line after my graduation from that two-year program, and it's been fantastic. So I have no regrets. I wish I had done it earlier. I'd been thinking about it for years.
Right.
So it's never too late.
See, transformation.
I'm so glad you said that, John, because one of the things that Alice and I like to talk about on the show, too, is we want to encourage people to get into the profession. Mm-hmm. And lots of people come at it from different angles and at different points in their lives. Some mm-hmm. people, like Kelly Norris, at 14, bought an iris farm. Do you know
right.
what I mean? Like, and other people start in their 50s and right. decide that they want to do it in some capacity. So it's just great to hear these stories and know that it's possible.
Right.
That, you know?
The staff that we have, the gardening staff, is largely like second career people, which is interesting. And, and a lot of them are, have an art background of some sort, whether it's illustration
ubiquitous design. Art background.
Right. Right. But it's interesting that all these people went through a similar journey, I think, in terms of getting to a point where they knew that this is what would satisfy them,
mm-hmm.
where other things weren't. And a lot of people left, I think, much higher paying jobs to do something that really made them happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think hiring Pete Odoff, right, for the plants, he's the master of seeing beauty in everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't have to be this planned British sort of design aspect. You know, he sees beauty in seed heads.
Right.
He sees beauty in the death of a garden, which is what I really love, is that you can look at a garden at any point and see something relevant.
And beautiful.
And beautiful. And that's how we should live our lives.
Right.
I don't, you know, we're so caught up in, like, the end point, right? It needs to be like this. Things need to work out this way. But there's a beauty in the process that gets lost.
No, correct. I think that Pete had a profound understanding of subtleties.
Mm-hmm.
I think the garden itself, you're saying transformation, maybe for me it's evolution through the seasons,
mm-hmm.
where at any given moment there's always something happening, you know, 20 or 30 spots along the line or more. And it's this thing that unfolds slowly, and it's quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is my opinion, but he was never about this big wow pop thing. It was always about something just slowly unfolding, you know, intertwining, turning. And you walk through that line at, you know, any given week, and you have a totally different experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you look carefully, it's amazing the subtlety of color changes, you know, especially as we go into fall and you start seeing.
Oh, it's the best time,
yes.
I think
yeah.
the late summer into
right.
fall is my personal favorite time
right.
up
Pete,
there.
My favorite quote of his is, brown is also a color.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And if you go
yeah.
out there and you have an open mind, most plants people go out there and they are really into it and they love it. Some people don't understand it, but if you go out there and really, really look, you'll see so many incredible shades of color. They're just
right.
amazing. And
right.
then you've got pops of, you know, not browns or beiges, but, you know, reds or berries or blacks that come in.
Purples, right.
Purples. And it's still beautiful and worth celebrating. You know, there's never a time that I would tell anybody is a better time to go there.
Mm-mm.
Each time is different. I just mm-hmm. think it's, you just need to take some time, slow stroll and look around, and you'll discover a lot of stuff that's happening.
Well, two quotes from Pete. Pete says, I think it would be wrong if everything was in flower. We expect it to die down and lose its leaves, and we appreciate decay more than most other gardeners. We try to make gardens where you don't have to really change your plants during the season. We appreciate plants that die down for the winter. We leave things on the plant instead of deadheading. After all, a seed pod can be just as pretty as a flower. There's beauty in everything, even in plants that die, as we approach the winter solstice.
Yeah, I know. And you know what's interesting that we're talking about this? Yesterday I went into the garden and we had just had 2 days of really cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a tropical plant in the garden called Brilantia. And it had very small purple flowers. It turned completely black.
Mm-hmm.
I just forgot to take it out. And it was so beautiful in its death
uh-huh.
that I cut it and used it in an arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I totally get that.
Yeah.
You know, it was more beautiful dead than
alive.
So strange.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Pete actually chose a lot of his plants as much for structure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is
right.
interesting because he really celebrated the structure of skeletal form of something after it went dormant as you know, equally as to what it looked like in flower.
Right.
Well, the grasslands and the prairie are really a big theme on, and natives are really a big theme.
We have
in the design schematic.
It is. It's interesting in that we have around 600 plus species of plants on the line, of which only about half are true natives. So a lot of people have that misconception. The rest are either non-natives or cultivars of natives. So it's a combination. Pete was not so obsessed with making everything native. He was more, I think, trying to get a palette and a sequence, a blooming sequence that would work, structure that was going to work. So there was never a time in the season that it actually looked not, I think, right, or not having a really great moment.
Right.
So,
in prepping for today's interview, John, you sent some photos around of some of, you know, your favorite plants, and granted, you sent them to me on the 30th of November.
Correct.
I looked it up. And you sent this amazing picture of Cotinus grace, is the variety of the Cotinus grace.
Correct.
And I thought it's so fitting that grace and transformation, you know, go together. Like, here we are approaching the solstice, talking about winter. We're talking about life change and how to become a gardener and when does gardening begin in people's lives, and, you know, and this elevated crumbling infrastructure that is now this like gorgeous park. So talk a little bit about the Cotinus grace.
Cotinus grace is actually a good example of another non-native that Pete chose. It's a cross between the European smoke bush, European Asian smoke bush, and the American smoke bush. And it was chosen by him for its incredible and brilliant early spring color, which then is followed by this amazing, amazing flower, which we obviously can't see the photograph, but
you can see this on social media.
Okay.
I posted it on Instagram.
Okay.
Yep.
And then in fall, probably one of those brilliant orange, red, fiery color that you can really appreciate early morning light when the sun is coming through it. It's just something you can't really describe. It's that beautiful. It has a very interesting and kind of odd form. A lot of visitors refer to it as a Dr. Seuss tree. Because it's got these sort of weird tufts balls. We have a management program where every 2 years we actually cut these back pretty hard and start that growth over again so they don't get out of hand.
They can get very leggy, right?
They get very leggy, and we are extremely windy, so we need to be careful that, you know, that's taken care of. So we have this program where we'll do half in one period, 1 year, and then we'll do the other half. So you're never doing something so drastic that you can actually notice that we're made a big change in those beds. So we'll always balance it out half and half.
And then the aster, right?
Yes.
Radon's favorite.
Radon's favorite. Another great, great, I think, fall focus.
Fragrant.
The leaves are very fragrant. It's got a really intense aroma. It's one of my favorites, probably because it's a great pollinator. It's covered in bees more than most other plants. I was out in the line today, this morning, and it's still blooming. So if you have the right weather, which I think we're just about to not have the right weather, but you'll have you'll have blooms in, you know, easily into December. Also, I think in terms of the type of levels of light that you have, we'll cut back. We do have some of them planted in woodlands, and they'll have a later bloom time than they will if they're up front. So it's a great plant.
I love that plant, and it's so perky. Like, it's just so...
It is perky, but we need to cut it back once or twice.
It's pretty aggressive, right?
Yeah.
It kind of rambles.
It does ramble. I don't consider it aggressive, and I think it's more about just keeping it in check. I slowly pull it back. But if you don't cut it back... like 12 inches, probably high, eat one or two times a year, it'll actually flop. So when you see ours that are so bushy, it's because we're actually taking the time to slowly cut them back starting in June.
And let's talk about Ilex verticillata, because...
Tis the season.
You don't have to have plastic berries on your wreath if you have Ilex verticillata.
That's right. Red Sprite.
Yeah, this is one I grabbed just because it's a great punch of color in a winter landscape. And if you see this in the wild, that's not that's a cultivar. Yeah. It's a much lower and a larger berry. I think it's red sprite, as you said. In the wild, you see these in a in woodland, sort of peppered across the bottom, the bottom layer of the of a woods, yeah. And you see the sparkling red. We have that in a more pulled back scale, but I like to see that with the gray birches, mm-hmm. where you have these punches of red. Kind of, you can't even see the branches or stems. You see this sort of this punch of color, little specks of red throughout the woodland, and it's a great thing for winter interest. The berries for persist mm-hmm. until they're eaten, usually by the mockingbirds.
The birds.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and then Iris domestica. And you sent me a picture of the seed heads mixed right. with Calamagrostis.
That's a good example. That's actually in another gardener's area, Aranek, and it's an example of how Pete's very willing to work with us, and he visits us about once a year, and we do have talks with him. So he's very hands on. It's great. But she had made a suggestion. There's a Calamagrostis up there. I always call it Brachytrica, but they just changed the name to I can't remember. But it was a very large standing of this, a very erect, beautiful grass. Mm-hmm. In the photograph, you'll see that. And she was trying to figure out a way to break that up, and she did the Iris domestica, which is the blackberry lily, and it's really a stunning moment. And you need to go there and look at it, uh-huh. And it'll be stunning probably through winter. But you've got this really almost like these black pearls floating in this really beautiful, almost like a forest of these grass seed heads, which are very erect, and they'll stay upright through most of the winter. But Pete looked at it and he agreed and thought it was a good idea. And it's an example of how, Pete in the end is the one who calls the shots in terms of what we're doing, but he does listen to gardeners in terms of what they find or suggest.
So mm-hmm. if he does a plant, he's an excellent plantsman, but if something isn't quite working, the plant palette evolves too, right?
Yes.
A little.
Yeah. I believe it's all about evolution.
Okay.
As we have so much change along the Highline, specifically in construction.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, full sun gardens that suddenly will become shade.
Yes. Right, because a building goes up.
Right. Yeah. So we're always looking at how to stay ahead of that.
Mm-hmm.
And
that Department of Planning.
No, it's actually insane. I don't know how much of our beds are covered in scaffolding right now. But we're constantly adjusting things for that. We also have a lot of growth. A lot of our trees are getting bigger, and mm-hmm. so we have a lot more shade in our woodland areas. So we're trying to find replacements for the herbaceous layer, the layer, because it's going to a much shadier condition. And we work with Pete and find the right choices. And I think the changes that happen, it's always very important for me as a gardener in my area that they're done in a way that's very, it's never like bam in your face. It's very slow. It's something that always seems natural. And then mm-hmm. we do plant in a very naturalistic style.
Mm-hmm.
So it's things that are planted as if that's how they would grow in nature.
Right. Right. Well, let's talk about those big betulas, those big birch trees.
Yes.
How much soil are they planted?
Yes. How are they planted in on a train bed? Because we know that they need at least 28 by 28.
The betula populifolia are fairly shallow rooted.
Uh-huh.
We have a soil depth that averages 18 inches.
Okay.
So it's not that deep, but it's not that simple. At some points, our plant beds, because of the topography of the underbelly of the line, could go to 24 or 30.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you ever see a metal planter on the line, mm-hmm. the core 10, you could add that to the 18. That's a plant bed that's being raised.
Because they raise up. Yeah.
So it is enough. They're actually doing almost too well. They're doing great. We
yes.
have a tree management program where we're trying to open up the canopies.
Yeah, because these will get 60 feet tall if they're let go.
Those won't. Those
40?
Won't.
40?
They're like 30, 35.
Okay.
Betula nigra gets much bigger.
Right.
And there is one of those in the field. And we'll have to, watch that.
But
the trees are very, very happy.
Do you do root pruning?
We have not. I mean, we've done things where we're removing entire trunks of trees just to thin things out. We've got a lot of, multi-stemmed, seven stems, and we might take out one or two.
No.
We'll keep an odd number usually. Just to get some light in there, and mm-hmm. it's made a huge difference. I mean, you mm-hmm. can't tell that anything's being taken out because it's done in a way that's very natural. But our undergrowth, the herbaceous layer is actually coming back, and I've been able to plant additional things and keep that going. We've changed the plant palette, at least in Gansevoort Woodland. It's looking good. So it's sort of a season at a time and a lot of observation.
So you gardeners go, like you each kind of have a zone or like a...
We do.
Destination?
So I... Yeah. I'm speaking in my zone just because I'm more familiar with it. But yeah, each gardener has a zone. I have from Gansevoort to 14th Street, if you're familiar with the park. So it's Tiffany, Overlook, Gansevoort, and Washington grasslands. It's around 21,000 square feet, so it's a lot of garden bed. We have 124,000 roughly square feet of garden bed, and it's divided up into, I believe it's 8 zones, and it's one gardener per zone, and 2 gardens, I think, have 2 part-time employees as well.
Okay. That's a lot of space.
It's a lot of space. It's actually a lot of space for not that many gardeners.
Right, right.
If you're a gardener, you'll understand that because there's a lot of work that's done. We have volunteers as well that help us out on a almost full-time basis.
I think it's time for us to
take a break.
Right? So stay on the line. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arrival to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer, and trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org. Sweep me up into your
hands, then scatter me. Hi, we're back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network, and we're talking plants today and transformation with John Gunderson, Senior Gardener at the Highline. So let's talk about the methods of maintenance, because I think people who aren't gardeners, who are not familiar with what it takes to maintain a garden, may think that that style of garden doesn't require that much maintenance.
It's a prairie.
Right.
What do you need to do?
So let's disabuse people of this notion right now, John.
Yes. It's actually a highly cultivated garden.
Yeah.
I always look at it as the other gardeners do. It's almost like you're trying to keep this image that's always changing, but in check. Because everything is running and everything is, not everything, but many things are fighting to take over valuable space.
Just like every New Yorker.
Right.
Yes.
So it's almost like the strongest plant will survive. And as gardeners, we're constantly keeping that image alive. And it's always changing, but we know what that picture is. And we're grooming, we're taking things back, we're constantly battling with weeds, we're constantly keeping the species that were specified in the area from staying there and not allowing any other species in. Unless it's approved.
You're sounding like Donald Trump right now. Are you going to build a wall between the plants?
No, we won't.
And birds, and, you know, birds drop seeds, I'm sure.
Yes.
And the wind brings seeds. Cause such an, you know.
Yeah.
So do you use organic practices usually?
It's completely organic.
Okay.
There's no chemicals on the line.
That's awesome.
So we're proud of that. We have only organic program.
Where is your storage area?
Storage is...
Because that's the hardest part of New York,
like
storage space.
It's storage and distance. So we do have 2 storage areas. One is in our headquarters building, which is at Gansevoort, below the Whitney, which is a decent amount of storage, not a lot. And the other one is at a place called the Spur, which is roughly 16th Street.
Okay.
But it's always a struggle. I think the bigger struggle is, we also have some storage at 34th Street.
Okay.
I think the bigger issue is the distance. It's 1.45 miles as far as getting stuff back and forth.
Yeah, right.
It's almost like, an hour walk back and forth, you know, and that's...
So that's a commute. You get to work and then you have to commute to work.
I am lucky. I'm actually at the very beginning of our office, but, you know, kudos to the gardeners that actually have to do this, two, three times a year.
Yeah.
I mean, a day, sorry.
Right.
And you... there's no elevator access. You have to just use the stairs to get materials up, or do you have
elevators? No, we have elevators.
You have elevators. Okay, so you can.
Yeah, we're pretty, it's pretty well, you know.
But you can't get any heavy equipment up there.
No,
It's all hand.
No, we do. We have a freight elevator that goes from street.
Oh, you can?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you do have a little bit of that.
Yeah. I think we're decently set up.
So I've seen you a couple times, like, weekdays, I've seen you gardening. It's very crowded all the time in the park.
Yes.
Yes.
If I decided when I was in school that I wanted to go into public gardening, and I think there's probably not a more public space than this space.
Right.
Small. It's small. The paths are small for the most part. You're talking about like an 8 or 9 foot path.
Uh-huh.
And you do have to love people, and we do communicate with our visitors on a daily basis. It's encouraged, but you just need to be ready. You know, in the mornings is a lot of times where we get most of our work done, and we still work in the afternoons. But we have, I think, the numbers for this year. They're projecting over 7.5 million. So that's, if you just do the math, it's like 144,000. A week, which is probably actually more loaded heavily in the summer.
Yeah,
that's a lot of people.
Right, and there you are trying to get work done, and people are talking to you, and you're.
It's an added challenge, but it's still part of the job, and I think, you know, we're all there for a reason. The garden is pretty incredible. There are other jobs out there if it's something that you're not happy with. I personally do like engaging with the public, and they encourage it because you know, people have a lot of questions about plants, and I don't mind taking the time. To do that.
So irrigation.
Irrigation.
How do you water these plants on an elevated trestle?
We are, well, I'd say first off, we are fully irrigated, but we rely probably most heavily on hand watering because it's probably the best way to go, or at least let's say as a decent component to our watering. Some areas on the line are not irrigated at all, so those definitely have to be hand watering. But when you hand water, it's the time that you actually observe what needs to be done or what's running or what's, you know, possibly on its way out or whatever. But with that, we have a full drip system and spray heads mostly in wooded areas. And this is fully programmable through a computer. So we can basically monitor and moderate it in any number of
Do you manage
ways.
That as well, John? Is that part of your responsibility, too,
to It's part adjust? Of three. It's our responsibility. It's myself, Aaronek, and I dropped his name.
So you have to adjust it regularly.
And so you just say, like, hey, we're having a problem over here with these betulas, and let's get them.
If people have any issues, because it's all about observation. Mm-hmm. And irrigation you can't rely on because you never know when it's going to possibly stop working.
Right.
So you're constantly looking at this stuff. And people will report back to me, Aaronek, and Aaron that if anything's going wrong, we'll adjust it slowly.
Okay.
And I think we err on the watering on the left side more than on the plus side. Mm-hmm. And I think that what falls in between that is hand watering.
Mm-hmm.
And we were set up in a way, it's like every 20 feet, we actually have a quick connect coupler. So
that's
amazing.
Oh, that's great.
We use irrigation on almost all of our projects. And it's a double-edged sword, as Alice and I know, because most of our clients, there isn't somebody at their house looking at it and paying attention to the gardens on a daily basis. They rely too much on the irrigation. You know what I mean? Like they just, and it causes a lot of problems.
Yeah,
you know,
I think the key,
you know,
to all of this is you're trying to keep your plants as unstressed as possible and as happy as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's really just delivering the correct amount of water. It's not about overwatering. The irrigation system is not a solve-all.
Yeah.
So we really try to look at it and pull it back as much as possible. And there's nothing more disappointing than finding out that one of your heads that you didn't realize had a break in it, you know, was flooding a bed for, you know, a week or so.
Yeah.
Right.
So we monitor that carefully. And, you know, originally they'd hoped that most of the plants are drought tolerant, that we would need nothing.
Right.
But that seems to not be the case because we are a strange microclimate. We've got winds much stronger than at street level.
Yeah, you're all drying the time. Out.
So we're drying
so
out very
fast.
So
yeah, yeah.
It's always changing season by season, the way we used the irrigation system and how much we're watering, et cetera.
Yeah. And then this fall was extremely dry. I mean,
correct.
And so, you know, there's been strange seasonal stuff, excessively warm, excessively dry. So you have to have that backup, but I think people rely on it too much. That's what I was trying to say. It's just they really a lot of people do think of it as just, oh, I turn it on and
it works and it's fine.
Right.
Or clients will say, oh, it's October, it's time to shut it off, as if there's like a magic time when plants don't, you know.
Our magic time is it needs to be shut off before we get a hard freeze.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly. But of course it can be backed down to that point, you know.
But I think hand watering is the way to go for the most part. Our area is so big, I don't know if we could just hand water. But.
Well, like you said, eyes on the plants. I mean, there's no better indicator.
Yeah.
Then,
and there's nothing more pleasant than watering a garden and actually having time to rest and just look at stuff.
Oh, it's so awesome. So, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually when I come home from work, that's actually, I don't do much in my front container garden because I'm tired, you know, and it's my husband's job, frankly. I tell him what to do. But watering the plants is like just to have that hour of like really looking and seeing what's going on and what bugs are present. And
it's not as fun as weeding.
Well, I'm a pruner.
I'm a pruner.
I'm happy with the loppers and the pruners. That's my favorite garden task, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I confess.
So let's also talk about, so there's tons of visitors, right? But there's also a lot of programming that happens alongside these gorgeous plants.
Right.
So the High Line is first and foremost a public park for the neighbors and for New Yorkers. It offers a lot of free programming to reflect that public nature. And they do things like youth employment programs. They're hoping to educate more people in the community about horticulture and the work that you, John, do. And hopefully get the community excited about engaging and working with plants and public spaces. So I know you guys offer a lot of stargazing. You have a lot of music events. You have a lot of art installations throughout the year. There's a couple of things that are coming up. One is the winter solstice, December 21st. That starts at 5 p.m. It's called The Gates. Right? And tell us a little bit about The Gates, John. What?
I'm actually not the one that can answer that.
Okay.
I'm actually mostly the horticulture stuff.
It's a soundscape kind of program. Yeah.
I think there might be a description there in terms of what Cubbid sent you.
Yeah. So it sounds like there's a score of electric guitar chords, Zen gongs, and more.
That sounds fun.
You can participate.
That sounds really fun.
The and more part, yeah.
It seems like it's interactive. So
I believe that that is true. It's an interactive piece that you connect to.
And there was
it changes as you walk through the park.
And the art, the public art changes periodically. There's always some interesting art.
The public art, it's more like a, within the backdrop of the gardens themselves, it's almost like a gallery. We have sculptures that change every year.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes you come back to see your favorite's gone, but every year there'll be a new series of sculptures throughout the line.
Right.
Yeah,
this year was amazing. You had the sculpture, right? That was in your area, the naked man or the underwear man?
No, the underwear man is, which has a name, the sleepwalker.
The sleepwalker. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's actually at 14th Street.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm walking along, and all of a sudden it bottlenecks. And I'm like, oh, okay, maybe there's like a food vendor there or something. And then I look, and I'm like, is that guy real? Like, there, everybody was photographing themselves with it,
right.
Taking selfies, and it was, it took me probably half an hour to realize it's a sculpture.
Yeah.
Wow.
I guess I see him so much that
yeah,
you stop
looking, but it is so unbelievable of this man walking, sleepwalking.
Yes. Now, there's interesting works of art.
Is it done in conjunction with the Whitney, or you have your own?
No, it's all separate. It's all
okay.
Separate. So,
okay. Because the Whitney is, you know.
The Whitney's right there.
Right there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But there, you know, in almost every zone, there'll be a different sculpture throughout.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
All the way to
right.
34th.
Right. And then you also have some winter tours on the High Line. So.
Yeah, we have tours that happen all the time, so uh-huh. including winter. They probably are less frequent in the winter.
Uh-huh.
But there are gardener-led tours and then docent-led tours. There's bird-watching tours.
Right.
But these, you know, the programming is much heavier in the warmer months.
Right.
And you can find all that out on the website.
Do you lead some of the tours, John?
I lead tours for just visitors who have signed up, and also for private tours for different organizations or companies.
Oh, that's interesting. And you said you have a big core of volunteers, too, right?
We have a ton of pretty wonderful volunteers, starting out with what we call Cutback, which is our spring event,
uh-huh.
One of our maintenance techniques, because we can't burn a prairie, but we can cut it back mm-hmm. in early spring. And because of the amount of square footage, we're talking about something that we, as the gardening staff itself, would have a very hard time doing before new growth would be happening. So we have around 150-plus volunteers.
That's cool.
That come in over between 4 and 6 weeks, and we start out at one end, south or north or middle, and slowly spread out until we've cut everything back, and then we compost everything fully.
Oh, uh-huh. That's cool.
So, and then everything's returned back to the line.
Where do you compost, John?
We have a facility in what I'm calling the spur, where I talked about our storage. So we actually do process all of our cutback material. So
that's great.
Nothing is brought to fresh kills. It's all turned mm-hmm. into our own compost.
Wow. And I'm sure you have a lot of material that you
We have a ton of material. We have, I had these numbers and I have them in front of me, but during cutback, I think we're producing like 33
3x3
yard bags per week.
Uh-huh.
And that's part of the gardener's responsibility too, is to manage the compost or no?
No, we are. We do that as well. And we also have, like, some of our, we're talking about, you know, volunteers or programming. Mm-hmm. I think the teens might be part of that. We don't know because we just interviewed them. So we'll see. But, yeah, we do manage that with other volunteers. It's an ongoing thing. It never stops.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, compost, unfortunately, doesn't just stop.
Doesn't go away.
And is that how it's fed? There's no additional feeding, or is there?
No, they do. I'm not the compost person.
Right.
That's Casper and Mark and some others. But they do feed stuff. They'll bring in. We have local shops that give us coffee grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on if you need a little bit more wet
to balance
or
out
dry
the
to balance it out, and they do monitor it. And we have.
But I mean, in addition to compost, is the garden fed? Additionally?
You mean the garden beds themselves?
Yeah,
We do compost tea applications,
mm-hmm.
and we do compost. We'll actually put down
and that's
layers
it.
Of mulch.
And nothing synthetic?
And that's it. No, there's no synthetic. So it's all natural, and we have the soil tested, and we're actually doing pretty good. We were surprised, but we're fairly okay nutrient-wise across
the country. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So
18 inches.
18 inches going up to some of the tree pits are deeper. And if you go to the flyover, for example, you've got mounds that might, you know, you might be talking like 48 inches.
Yeah.
Depth.
Right.
So, but 18 inches is on average what our soil is.
So free winter tours every Saturday through the winter at noon. Check out the High Line website, thehighline.org, to learn more about the programming, the theory, the history, the gardens, like the art. It's such a great organization.
And the people.
Yeah. It's such a great organization, and New York is so lucky that we have it.
Yeah. And it's another example of community people. There were two people that lived in the community that rescued it initially, that it was their idea.
It was started out, and they had no idea what they wanted to do with it.
No, so. Right. But they wanted. They knew that they didn't want the city was in the was wanting to potentially tear it down.
Right.
And imagine they had vision.
Yeah.
You know.
No, correct. They were. Yeah. They were great.
Yeah.
They just needed the money.
They did.
and they raised the money.
Yes, they did.
And that's what has, you know, transformation, right? They yes. have transformed that entire side of Manhattan.
Right.
I think, and you probably agree with me, John, that the High Line made the neighborhood and not the other way around, right? In the sense of development. Right.
Well, Battery Park City and the whole greening of the Hudson River, you know.
Right. I think that.
Or that's, actually, maybe accelerate.
That's the easy way. I think it might be part of that.
Yeah.
Acceleration, but the area itself was a big art gallery area.
Right. Right.
So that was what was
Soho
actually
had moved into those big warehouses,
right. And it maybe was the appropriate time for this to happen.
Exactly.
Right.
But it did have a part.
It has an impact. I mean, it's a great destination. So.
Yeah.
So just as an old rusty railway can bloom into a great pedestrian botanical destination, just as us gardeners plant and hope for a better future, and just as the seed head is elevated and appreciated for what it holds in its interior, we hope 2017 is better and more peaceful and full of beautiful change for humanity. John, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you.
Thanks for all your work at the High Line.
Yeah, come visit early.
Yeah, early in the morning is best. That's an insider's
view.
No,
it's beautiful. There's no one there. So
there's nobody there, right.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you all for listening to us on We Dig Plants. You can join us on Facebook at Groundworks, Inc., We Dig Plants, on Twitter at We Dig Plants. We also have an Instagram account, Groundworks Gardens NYC, and, of course, our website, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com. Thank you for listening. See you in the garden.
See you in 2017.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.